kind of when I got hurt, I was never lightning fast, but I was never going to come back and be as quick. So you have to develop and learn, make other attributes stronger to kind of compensate for that. So yeah, I definitely think experiencing stuff, whether it's good or bad, but learning lessons and adapting to it, being open to do that as well, not being stuck in your ways and not being so cocksure of yourself that your way is always right.
Hey guys, and welcome to Take Flight with me, Mark Whittle, a peak performance podcast where we speak with the best in the world at what they do, so we can learn from their successes and their failures and apply these lessons to our own lives. The last episode went down so well with former head coach and player of Wigan Warriors, Sean Wayne. And this week, we're speaking to another Wigan legend who is still building his legacy. The guest for episode 50 and the half century episode of Take Flight is Sean O'Loughlin. Sean is an absolute legend, captain of Wigan Warriors, captain of England Rugby League, and one of the best players in world rugby. He's the Rugby League equivalent of Steven Gerrard for Liverpool, Kobe Bryant for the LA Lakers, or Tom Brady for the New England Patriots. And I don't say those names lightly, because Sean is an absolute hero and is definitely a one-man club. Coming into his 19th season at Wigan, what a legacy he's building. Over 400 appearances for club, with 4 grand final wins, 2 Challenge Cup wins, and 1 club challenge win. He's done so much in the game. I love this chat so much. It was so much fun. I hadn't seen Sean for ages, so it was really nice to be able to sit down. And he shares some amazing advice on handling pressure in big games, how to step up and take on more responsibility as a leader or as a manager, and how best to manage setbacks, whether through injury or other reasons, and how to get back on the horse, smash it and achieve your goals. For those who have heard Sean speak before, he's so humble and so laid back. Yet, when he crosses the white line and the whistle goes, it's a completely different story. He's such a genuine guy, and it was a pleasure speaking with him. I'm recording this on a Thursday morning, and the lads at Wigan are playing Castleford tonight. And Lockers is just back from injury, he's back in the fold, so it's so exciting for him. A massive good luck to Sean and my cousin Matty and all the lads at Wigan. Here's hoping you win. Without further ado, please enjoy the story of the Wigan captain and legend, Sean O'Loughlin. Sean, welcome to the Take Flight podcast.
Thank you very much. I'm a bit nervous. Don't really know what to expect. First podcast, anyway. Nah, it's something I've never done before, really. Podcast. Done interviews and things like that, but yeah. A little bit different, a little bit more chill than
I suppose. What's a media interview for you like? What's that? What, like a couple of minutes or something?
Yeah. TV stuff's always quite short. You don't really do a lot of live stuff in here. It's mainly pre-recorded.
Yeah.
What live stuff just on game days, really.
Yeah.
If you get caught at the game, but majority is radio and recorded stuff.
Yeah, well, mate, I'm really pleased we're doing it. Nice to have a chance to chat. I was just saying,
it's good to catch up again.
Yeah, it's been 2 years since I've seen you last, so.
Yeah. Not a lot of change, really. Still cracking on, still putting the boots on.
Yeah, mate, still smashing it. I love it.
Yeah, still going all right.
So, just saying as well, I just sat down with Sean Wayne.
Yeah.
Your old coach.
Yeah.
I was saying to him, I was seeing you afterwards, and I said, what should I ask him? And he said, don't ask him anything, just say that he's a cheating fucker.
I know exactly what he's talking about as well. He'll be on a bit of crossbar at the club.
Yes, he was, to get out of a 30 quid coffee round or something.
He's only saying that because he is the biggest cheating bastard I've ever played with. Just at that game, but he says I'm bad. If you ask any of the other boys, they'll all agree he's the worst. He's the worst in the team.
So what, you're getting him back in those games, or was it just a one-off?
Yeah, I don't know if you explained the game, but we played it all season. End of every game, just crossbar from 20 metres out, last in it, buys the coffees that
whole squad.
Yeah, but then there was like a league, so whoever lost the most come end of the season, you took everyone out for lunch.
Yeah.
So it was you're talking 500-600 quid at end of the year if you lost it. So it was about 10 of us, 8 of 10 or 12 of us played it, but he lost a couple. He lost a couple. Took us out for lunch a few times, but he would cheat. He would do anything he could to make me lose it. there was about a 2 month period where he had a bad knee. He had an operation, but he was still coming out playing, and we absolutely peppered him. it was vulnerable, bad knee, so the boys were just on him. but he'd have done the same. There was a time I would say I didn't play for about a month. So I got someone subbing for me, and I could see him through the windows. I was training on the treadmill or whatever, and I could see him just smashing whoever it was, all young kid playing for me, and he's just shoving him, kicking him, and all sorts. But yeah, he's a cheat.
Anything goes to win, isn't it? Anything necessary.
Yeah, yeah. And because once he'd done it to me, I was just on him. Then I was doing it back, and it just escalated as the season went on, and got worse and worse and worse.
Mate, that's brilliant. I love that you guys and you boys still have the fun attached to it. So where did it all start for you, mate? When were you introduced to rugby? When did you start to realise that you were good at it?
Family wise, like my dad's brother, uncles, they had a history at Wigan and other clubs as well, so they played growing up. My brother played, all my male cousins played. I probably picked the ball up first when, well, not picked the ball up, joined the team when I was about nine, probably when I started junior school.
Yeah.
The headmaster there, Mr. Mallon, he's known in throughout Wigan as
really?
His kind of contribution to like schoolboys rugby. Now he coached my lad last year. He just started to jump his high school.
He's coaching your kid.
Yeah, great fellow. He's around the corner actually, but he's a real good bloke. So he would have been one of my first coaches at age nine, and then just progressed from there. School rugby, joined the club, started high school. My high school was big into rugby as well, so it was just a natural progression. I think with a lot of boys from Wigan, you tend to. You'll try your arm at some point playing rugby. So it's my group of friends growing up, they were all keen rugby players, all good players. So it was kind of an easy thing to do.
Yeah, and did you ever play other sports? Or was it always rugby?
Yeah, football. Never played for any other clubs outside of school. But both schools I went to, luckily, was like Sacred Heart Junior School and John Fisher High School. They both played a lot of sport. So football, cricket, tennis. Table tennis. There's always stuff going on at school, so it was a good place to grow up with sport involved.
Yeah, nice, mate. And were you one of those who was good at everything, or did you just have a gift in rugby?
I weren't that good at football. Played centre back at football. I think I scored about four own goals and maybe got one goal during my career. But I was physically all right at football. I could quake and that, but I didn't have the touch at football. But yeah, rugby wise, it was kind of natural, came natural to me, and probably enjoyed that more than any other stuff.
And did you have, I know your dad was obviously massive in rugby as well and had a great career. Who were your sort of key mentors as you grew up?
Yeah, definitely my parents. They'd be big ones. I think because my dad had played the game, knew the script, probably coming to like the age when you start realising, oh, you might be able to sign for somewhere. My dad was very level about that. I think she sees some kids getting a bit carried away, and my dad was always adamant to finish school before I signed anything, because a lot of kids might, at that time, it doesn't happen now, but at that time they were signing them at 11, 12 year old and giving them a bit of cash and tying them up. But nowadays they don't do that, but I think my dad was always adamant for me, if you're decent enough, you'll do something when you leave school.
So was that a case of like 11, 12-year-olds would sign and leave school and go and play?
No, not necessarily. It wasn't not like the football route. It was just you'd stay on at school, and it wasn't a matter of not finishing school. It was more if they saw a bit of potential in you, they'd try and offer you some money to sign.
Right.
And Wigan did that. Warrington were doing it, Leeds, but no one does it now, but I think my dad at the time was more just not necessarily stay in school, work out at that. That was a case no matter what. But I just don't think he felt the need to be signing contracts as like an 11, 12 year old lad.
It's quite a big thing to do, isn't it? I suppose it's a big distraction as well. Your old man probably wanted you to focus on.
Yeah, when I say I started playing at nine, it was never through my dad going taking me down to a club or anything like that. It was more just he let me find my own feet. With the group of friends I was in.
Yeah.
And it was more down to that. But yeah, he always kind of critiqued me again, but always in a positive way. He never made it feel like, oh, you could potentially play rugby. It was never like that. It was always the fun side of things. Yeah. I was just playing the game.
That's amazing, mate. Did you watch him play?
I have memories of kind of being at, I think back end of his career, played at Salford, and I have memories of being at the Willows, the ground there. But I can't remember him playing too much. I would have been probably a bit too young.
Yeah.
I think when he did finish, he played a few games for Beech Hill Bulldogs and that kind of stuff in the Kenji Cup, what's a big cup in Wigan. All the amateur clubs playing it. So I remember a few then, but probably from his, well, not professional, his semi-professional days, I don't really remember him too much.
Yeah.
A bit too young.
it's interesting, mate. It's like, it's kind of like a way of life, isn't it, rugby, really, in Wigan?
Yeah, yeah. Like my lad now, he's 12, going on 13, and he likes playing rugby, but watching it or anything like that, he's not too, he'll take it or leave it, which I think's good, really, because I think he could easily get, because I've played the game, he could easily feel under pressure that he has to go into it, and he's, hopefully he doesn't feel that, but just if he does want to play, and he does, which he does play at the minute, but if he likes it and he wants to try and make something of it, then it's his own choice.
Yeah, that's amazing, mate. That's a really good outlook. I think a lot of parents would put more pressure on people, wouldn't they?
Like, yeah,
they
definitely.
Really want them to be, like, follow their footsteps or something.
Definitely, like, the team he plays for, the good, great bunch of parents, though, but you see, he's getting to that age now where people are starting to take it a bit more, probably serious than they should do, and you do see some sights on the touchlines. But
did you say he's into football? He likes football.
He's probably more of a football fan. He did play for a team. He's not so much. He's not playing now. He plays at school, but I don't know. It must be something to do with FIFA and Instagram and all that. But he knows every single player in the world, and I'm like. He's a big United fan. He knows all the updates and all the signings and everything. I'm like, I've never even heard of that person before.
Is he a Sean Loughlin fan though?
I think so. He doesn't tell me too often, but yeah, I think he is. He's probably more of a glory hunter. He probably supports the guys who score more tries.
So what about after you did get picked up by the club, mate? When did you kind of start to feel like it was something you'd want to pursue? And when contracts came round, what was going through your head at that point?
It's probably that last couple of years at school when you're having clubs sniff around you, inviting you down for training days. I remember going down to Leeds and spending a weekend down there playing a game with them. And yeah, but as I said, parents were kind of adamant. Finish school and then see where you are when you turn 16. So that was the case, and Wigan wanted us to sign, and I always wanted to sign for Wigan. My dad was always about entertain anyone else who comes. So if Warrington come in, go and see what they have to offer, go and experience that, see what it is. But I did always want to sign at Wigan, and I think my parents did as well, really. But as I left school, 16, signed, and then just started straight away in the academy. I remember as I finished school. Remember playing? I played in a school final for. They were all played at Central Park then, the old ground. Played a school's final there for the 5th years, the year 11s, and then I played for the academy like an hour later in the next final. I just my first ever game of the academy. I played like the year above because they were a bit short on numbers, so they
first game you already just played.
It was buzzing. First of all, playing at Central Park, which we were spoiled a little bit as school rugby then because you played all your finals there. But I played a final and then come off and boom, straight into another game for the academy. So it was a class start to it.
So that was the first time you put a Wigan shirt on?
Yeah, for Wigan, yeah. There was Wigan schoolboys growing up, which was like kind of under 11s, under 13s, 15s and 16s. So you got to put a shirt on them, but that was my first proper academy game for the club.
Yeah, mate, amazing. So, you're saying your dad said entertain other offers and stuff. I'm interested to know if you had other offers, because as a man who's ultimately ended up being a one-man club, building such a big legacy with Wigan, was there ever a time that it wasn't going to be them?
No, not when I was a kid, no. The problem, I can't really remember off the top of my head. There would have been a couple of offers, because I remember, as I say, I went to Leeds camps and I did a few things with Warrington. And I did entertain them, but yeah, it was always going to be Wigan as a kid. I think growing up supporting them. So it was always a dream to sign for them.
Yeah, and am I right in thinking that your first full debut, you basically replaced Andy Farrell, was it? Because he was injured.
I can't remember that, but yeah, I think I got told that recently. I do remember the game, because I think my first kind of friendly I played in Andrew's testimonial. It was Andrew's testimonial season. Played Hull. But then, yeah, I think my first proper first team game was against Hull again. I think I came off the bench and got my start, but yeah, it was a good moment for me.
It's amazing, mate. What was the sort of crowd like at that time?
Do you know what? It would have felt like it would chocker, because it was probably the first time I ever played in front of a decent crowd, a decent stadium. So yeah, it would have felt like it was bouncing.
Yeah.
It might not have been, but to me, first game, it was. It was probably about, it felt like it was about 80,000 people.
Whole world's watching.
I can't remember if it was on Sky or not, but I probably bumped straight home after the game, get it on Sky, watch it back again.
I love that.
But I remember the biggest thing I remember at the game, not so much what happened in the game, but just how much harder it was. I think my path was kind of academy. Then it was A team at the time, which was where you get to play against blokes and people who are older than you. Academy was always under 18, so but then the step up again to play first team, it just felt like 100 mile an hour. Like it was just chasing the game all the way through it. But it's just, I think that's just what happens. I think when you leave school, you play academy, you feel like that, and then when you go academy to the reserves, you feel like that, and then it's just that step up. Remember when my first international game, I played, it felt like that again. You feel like you come on here and whoa, this is a step up.
What is that feeling? Because I'm trying to relate it back to I never played rugby, but playing football, I always found it wasn't ever easier going a higher level, but because it was more risk on the defender side, I felt like you had more time.
Yeah.
Because people were less likely to like make a step towards you because you could beat them or something would happen or whatever. What was it that made it feel harder?
It was probably the fact that the game's quicker. The game's definitely quicker, but then you're dealing with bigger, heavier men as well, like big bodies. The wrestle side of things fatigues you, but then the game's faster on top of that. It's just a combination of having to handle big bodies, stronger players, and then also having to kind of execute everything faster and at a quicker pace. Yeah. It's just you two or three games in, you get used to it again. But I think it's just that initial shock of that, your first time you feel it, and it's like, whoa,
I'm a 20 stone guy.
I've not been here before. I've not felt this before.
What was it that you looked for? Because when I was talking to Wayne again earlier, I asked him what he liked as a player, what he was looking for. Was he looking to try and get over the line, which he laughed at that question.
Yeah.
Or was he looking to smash people? And he said, and like get the reaction from the crowd. And he said he was looking to smash and injure people.
It sounds about right. I think probably as a kid, I like scoring tries a little bit more than I do now. I don't really score that often now. But no, I think even as a kid, I liked, a bit like Wayne saying, I liked the hit, I like hitting people. Not so much getting hit, but
yeah.
I like smashing people.
And the reaction.
Yeah, that feeling when you catch someone good and you know you've hurt them. That's a good feeling. But also on the flip side, I like the kind of the delicate skill side of it as well. Like if you practice a move and you nail it and someone clean through the line, like that side of things, that's good. I like the skill attributes what come with it and being able to do that side of things as well. So it's probably on different ends of the spectrum really. It's one side of the just pure physical side of it. But then the more like the artistic side of the game, the offloading, the flicks, that kind of thing, they're good to watch.
Yeah, it's always hard asking people this question, but like, what would you say is your main strength?
I think my main strength now is I think I get more out of the players around me. I think I'm a player kind of lads enjoy playing with. I still do you obviously have to do the work, you have to put in the graft, you have to do the tackles, but I think because of quite experience now, the game management side of things, you have a different look on the game. You kind of see, just purely through experience, I think you see the way games are changing and moving on, but I still like the skill set side of things and almost making other players around you look good, look better.
Interesting.
That's kind of, I'm not going to go through a gap and score 100 meter try. I'm not quick enough to do that, and I'm not going to bust through millions of tackles. But I think doing stuff at the start of a play where at the end of it somebody does something like that. That's kind of, I get a lot out of that as well.
Yeah, is it almost like your ability to read that, even though it's not you that's going to do it? You know, the players around you are going to.
Yeah, given. A lot of it is about giving the person you pass the ball to, the person you move the ball onto, it's giving them time on the ball, or putting them in a position where they can do something.
Yeah.
So it might not necessarily mean I've created anything initially in front of me, but I've given someone some potential to create something on the back of it.
Yeah, amazing, mate. So does that get harder? Like, I'm just thinking that's obviously a really, really talented thing to be able to do. You're reading the whole pitch, you're reading lots of players at one time, both on your team and on the opposition. But does that get harder in different situations, like if you're in a grand final, for example, versus if you're just playing a home game against a team you normally beat?
Yeah, I reckon the the harder the game gets, like the higher the level, the internationals, like the pinnacle of that, it's almost like your moments where you do create stuff become less and less. Like games where you're winning 16-0, there's loads of opportunities in a game, and there's loads of times when you can get stuff on, you can sort stuff, you can get your players on. I think come you get to the end of it where internationals, you're playing in a big international game against Australia and New Zealand, it's almost like, one, the fatigue element, you're playing under fatigue a lot more. You're always kind of in that, at your top end, at your top range of being absolutely knackered. You're playing closer to that. And I just think you get less moments to kind of score. You get less moments to make a difference in the game.
Yeah.
Majority of the game is just nailing the simple stuff, nailing all your tackles, getting to your last play, and then you hopefully get an opportunity to do something. And coming, as I said, the top of your game, you the harder to break defences down, it's harder to kind of get something off the back of them.
Yeah, mate, it's so interesting. Speaking to Jamie George last year, who obviously went on the British Lions tour,
yeah.
And he was so funny, you say it, saying something very similar, that ultimately probably one of his best games ever played was the second test against New Zealand.
Yeah.
And he said the same thing, the secret to that performance was taking it back to the simple things, getting lots of touches, lots of time on the ball, but doing everything that he'd done all year, but the simple things the best he possibly could.
Yeah, 100%. It's like stuff what you don't probably think too much about in a league game, like to execute that probably at an international standard is just harder to do. And you have to just be more precise with everything. It's just more clinical. It's just a lot more clinical of a game. And there's probably more periods where it's just, from looking in, it doesn't look like there's much going on, but it's just set for set. But the kind of the exhaustion levels in their moments are like, people are just hanging in there. And as soon as somebody breaks, it's like, right, that's it, we're on. Now let's nail that moment.
So interesting, man. What was your highlight from the World Cup recently? Well, not that recent now, is it?
But yeah, probably that we played. Well, I got injured in the game and I missed. I didn't play in the final.
I know, it's such a shame, though, isn't it?
The Tonga game. This, I think it was the semi. The crowd, it was unbelievable. We rocked up at the stadium and it was just, everyone seemed to have red Tongan jerseys on and it was just bouncing. We played in front of some big crowds, but it was just had a different feel about it.
Yeah.
Like the, not hostile or anything like that. It was like almost like party-like. It was just they were cheering us. They were cheering Tonga. They were just cheering at everything. There was the singing. They were singing choir songs, and it just had a really weird feel, brilliant feeling about it. But it was nothing I'd experienced before. Normally, you go to an away game, which chocker, you're getting off the coach and people are giving it to you. You're getting booed, but there was nothing like that. I think even when we scored, they were cheering. It was just like a massive party atmosphere for them. It was unbelievable. I think because Tonga had been so successful and they weren't expected to be, they were just, not that they were, they knew, they felt we were going to go there and win them, because the side they had was unbelievable, and it come right down to the wire in the end. So it was just like a massive party. That's the only way I can explain it. The fans were loving it. Even some of the lads, I spoke to after it, they said the same. It was just like nothing you experienced before. Yeah.
Like you could even kind of feel that watching it on TV.
Yeah, it was bouncing.
Difficult question to ask because I know you're such a modest person with how talented you are and the things you've achieved. But do you think if you hadn't got injured that you guys might have won the final?
I don't know about it. That's kind of that game, watching it from the sideline. I want to speak about that. It's just like a massive energy battle throughout the game, and that was kind of one of the, without being in it, without feeling it, you could just tell it was one of that, them levels seemed like they're through the roof.
Yeah.
Like boys just playing at the absolute end of the limits, and it was just like that for so long in the game.
Yeah.
I don't know if it made a difference or not. You can't really answer that question. I'd have loved to play in the game. I'd have loved to be part of it. Even if we'd have lost, I'd have still loved to have been on the pitch and had a go at it. But not that we wanted to obviously go out there and win it, but it felt like we'd still not won anything, obviously, but we'd still done something pretty special from like the last World Cup and coming on to that, getting to the final, and probably kind of an ankle tap away from maybe kicking on and going winning it. It felt like we'd still done it, done the. like British rugby or English rugby prone, so it was still loved to be part of it.
Yeah, it was in a time as well where there wasn't much going on for British sport at the time, and I think it was really nice to see that. There was that moment where one of the Burgess brothers went through towards the end, wasn't there, as well?
Yeah, and there was a couple of more like moments in the game, like I said, and we just didn't quite get it. The one where Cal Watkins just got ankle tapped, and if he hadn't, I'm not saying 100% would have scored, but there was a good chance he had like a spot on the inside. He might have gone himself, but that puts it to 6-6, and you don't know from there. See what happens. But yeah, there was a few, just even the try there got like it was. That was probably a moment we, looking back, would have thought we should have stopped it, but we didn't quite get it. But yeah, you live and learn, don't you?
Oh, mate, absolutely. It's such a good message, though, because I think whether it's in sport or life or business or whatever, whenever we have these setbacks and failures or losses, you know, you said it almost felt like a win, even though you didn't actually win the tournament. It felt like a win because of what you'd achieved, and you can look back on the things that worked well. How did you guys like regroup as a squad, and how did you like get back together, and did you even need to pick morale up, or were people upset, or what was the camp like?
Yeah, I won't say upset. I think there was a huge sense of disappointment because we felt like we could have done it. We felt like we had the squad to do it, and we also felt the timing of it. It felt like if we'd have nailed that, then it would have been ours. And like four or five years later, if you go to the next one, you don't know what the squad's going to be like. You don't know what their squad's going to be like. We just felt like that was a big opportunity to get it, and we just missed out on it. So there was disappointment, but we licked our wounds after it, and then we had a great party the day after before we all went off our separate ways. So it was good. But one of the messiest plane rides home I've ever been on.
Really?
Yeah, it was. I think they stopped. They shut the bar down at one point and sent us all back to our chairs.
What was that flight as well? It was about 20 hours, wasn't it?
Yeah. Just a little stop in Dubai just to kind of refuel and then back
refuel
on
you lot or the plane?
Oh, we didn't need refueling. I think it was more for give us an hour or two off it.
So, mate, just to move a little bit away from the World Cup then, and talk about you as a professional and you being at the top of the game for such a long period of time as well. Captain of England, captain of Wigan, and in a sport that's so, so physical as well. I'd love to know a little bit about your sort of training regime, the sort of stuff that you're doing, whether it's gym work or on the field, and some of the stuff that you find that helps you get to peak performance, whether that's with like diet and nutrition as well.
My kind of training schedule now is a lot different than it was when I was like starting off and in my 20s. The pre-season's a lot more tailored to strength and almost like prepping me for the season, prepping me to get back running and get back putting the cares. And there's not much point now for me in probably doing the amount of running that the rest of the boys do. That's probably same for, it's tailored a little bit for probably lads approaching 30 and 30 plus, but where I am now, it's more about strength in the gym. I don't just mean kind of strength as in upper body, legs. It's a bit more like almost like pre-habit type strength, physio strength, doing a lot more stuff with them. Just all that injury prevention things are a lot of injury prevention stuff. So it's
like what would be an example?
Core work, hammy work.
Yeah.
Just the smaller muscle groups, really.
Is it more like functional movement as
well? Yeah, a lot of like single leg things, making sure there's no imbalances, calf work, just probably isolating muscle groups rather than not just doing squats, not just doing bench, just a lot more, just things I've probably had issues with, like calves and hammies, just almost hammering those and getting them up to speed before I start running. And that's been a big thing for me, yoga, hot yoga and things like that.
Yeah, when did you start doing that?
We had a lady come to the club, actually, who probably introduced us to it probably about 6 years ago, really. And I won't say I hammer it every week or anything like that. I kind of go through, I've probably not been there for about a month, but when I feel like I need it, I'll go and dip into it and do it a couple of times a week. And then if I'm feeling good, I might then start doing more in the gym and just swings it around a little bit. And it's somewhat different as well. So you're not, it's not the, you don't get that mundaneness of training, doing the same thing every day. I love training, but I like doing different things as well. Yeah. I like experiencing different stuff. Diet wise, I've never had to watch my diet too strictly. I don't put weight on easy. I don't lose it too quick. So it's I eat reasonably well, but I've never had to kind of diet too much to make weight. As soon as I start running, I tend to strip down quite quickly and get to my playing weight. My playing weight is kind of over. Starting in 2002, I was probably about 90 kg. I mean, weight's always probably put about a kg on a year since, up until the last few years, and probably playing weight now would be like probably 103-104 kilograms. So it's just, Jesus. I think it's been more of a my weight has always been a natural progression just as I've got older. Like when I was a kid, no matter how much weight I did, I was still always skinny, long neck, couldn't put weight on as a kid.
Mate, I would not want to be hit by you. 103 kg.
Yeah, but pre-seasons. I love pre-season. I love training with lads, but it's just not where I am now. I can't kind of do the cares they do and the miles. Can't put that kind of volume into my body and still be ready to go at the weekend.
So when you say where you are now, how old are you? And then how many seasons have you done? How many appearances have you got?
I debuted first team 2002, and I was 19 then. And I'm 36 now, 37 at the end of the season. I think I'll do one more season. Hopefully I'll do one more season. Yeah. Depending on how the body goes for the remainder of this one. But yeah, I want to do one more.
I remember you saying that to me 2 years ago.
Yeah, no. Then next year will be my 19th season. So
unbelievable, man.
I think I'm just coming up to 450 now games for Wigan. So it's a good, nice little milestone coming up if I can nail it.
You number one. You got the most appearances.
No, there's blokes kind of like Billy Boston and that era. I'm sure they're in the 700s, something really? Like that. Yeah.
What about Farrell, Andy?
I think I've got more than Andrew, but Andrew kind of left early. Went to Saracens as well, didn't he? He played a few games over there. I don't know what number Andrew's on. I think Rads is the probably Super League era. He'd have been one of the highest.
Yeah. So a bit of context. So. All obviously ex-Wigan players. Rad's era was what? Similar to Andy's, was it?
Yeah, yeah. 90s, early 2000s. Yeah. I think he retired 2004, something like that.
Yeah. Mate, do you know what I'd be really fascinated to hear is kind of the impact, whether there even was one, from Andrew and your relationship with him, and if you could share like what that is anyway, him being he's your brother-in-law, right?
Yeah.
And then what it was like also seeing Owen grow up, obviously, you know, being down there with the Saracens, but I'd love to hear a little bit about that and how you've been involved with them.
Yeah, so Andrew's married to my sister, and what would it have been? I'd have kind of been about 9 years old when they had Owen, so for me, when I came into the first team, I obviously knew Andrew well, and it probably made it easier for me coming into first team because I knew like Andrew, I knew Rads. I knew the Andrew rugby mates like Gary Connolly, Terry O'Connor, them kind of people that I'd been around them a little bit growing up, so it was a bit easier for me going to changing rooms and because I had a little bit of a footing already with them. Yeah. Probably took it a bit easier on me than they did some of the other young lads. But it was a blessing for me really. Them boys helped me out massively. When I come into the first team, there was a real strong group of senior lads though, the likes of Andrew Rads, Terry O'Connor, Terry Newton, Gary Connolly, some big names, like international players, and they run the team almost. So it was a good lesson in like leadership guys, strong characters, yeah. Good lessons and good people to learn off. They all trained hard, they all grafted away from rugby, they all kind of did extras away together. They had a good culture between them, and the young lads kind of got brought into that. If you was willing to kind of push yourself and do that, then they'd take you under the wing and help you out as much as they could. So it was a good team to come into. Probably for me, like fast forward that four or five years later, and a lot of them boys had gone. And we was quite a young team. I think that was when I got made captain, and it was different changing room at that point. It was a lot younger, didn't have that senior boys around, and it was to be captain at that time was probably a tough period, really. But
did you want it? How did that come about?
Well, when I got the captaincy, we'd got a new coach. I think it was Ian Millwood, and he made me captain. But the season before, I'd had a bad knee injury as well, so I'd barely played. So I was never going to say I didn't want it. Like, I didn't even think I didn't want it, but it would have probably, at the time, looking back now, it probably weren't the best option for me from a personal level. One, I was trying to find my feet form-wise because of my injury. I was more probably thinking, because I had a bad knee injury, the season I come back, it was more, will it still be all right? Will I kick on? So there was a bit of a drama going on anyway. But then with the captaincy side of things, when the team weren't going well, it was a bit of a shitty period, really. We were getting tonked every week and all sorts. But I reckon that them few years, I learned probably more on how to be a good captain, a good leader, than I did when through the good times. Almost, you learn more lessons in the tougher times than you do in the easier ones. But it weren't good, but I think it definitely helped me develop my kind of character and my leadership qualities almost.
It's interesting, man. I think a lot of people, even if you look at like business, if I use my example of in sales, and then there's sales managers, such a different role.
Yeah.
And you could just, I can just get on quite easy thinking about myself, my own jobs, what I've got to do. As soon as you step up into that leadership role, you've got 15, 20 or more in your case that you've got to think about.
Yeah, you've got to keep an eye on everyone else as well, haven't you? It is like that. And I think, the times I've found it easiest to captain, be captain, is when you've had probably five or six lads around you what could step in and do the exact same job you're doing.
Is that because you've shown them the way almost?
I wouldn't say I've shown them the way. I think kind of they've learned it themselves. They've grown into the positions. Like I'm 36 now. Then there's Tommy Lulawa, I think, what's 33-ish, something like that. He's one of them people who I'd say like he's part of the leadership group. And then there's like Tony Club, who's in his 30s. Liam Farrell, who's just coming up to his 30s. And that's not me. I think some of it's part of maturity, and some of it is just, you just grow into that.
Yeah.
But it is so much easier when you've got blokes around you can trust to do that for you as well.
Yeah, that's interesting, man. I suppose if you look back at a lot of impressive sports teams, they've all had that around them. They've got a group of, I don't know, it's hard to explain it. I use my example of Arsenal.
Yeah.
When Fabregas had the likes of Hleb and all his mates at the time, Flamini and all these boys who got on really well with each other. And that gives them the ability to, I suppose, probably have more confidence in the decisions they're making because people are backing what they're saying. And yeah, that's half of the battle, I suppose, isn't it? If you make a call and people disagree with you, you're losing your credibility straight away.
Yeah, 100%. And you can kind of put the feelers out with them kind of boys as well, because you know they're probably thinking the same as you are. They're thinking along the same lines. Yeah. And you can like, oh, what do you reckon about this? Is such a body? Is he pulling his weight here? Is he telling? And they'll be... And you can be honest with yourself if you think, oh, nah, he's doing all right. Give him a bit of time. You tend to be on the same wavelength a little bit. He needs telling him. Let's fire into him.
What do you think your leadership style is?
I've always felt it's always felt easier to me, as in making decisions and telling people what to do. When I've been nailing the rugby side of things, when I've been playing well, and I always feel like I need to be doing it on the pitch, and as long as I'm doing it on the pitch, I can almost say what I want to anybody then.
Is that because it gives you more confidence?
Yeah, I think it is just a confidence thing. When I said doing it on the field, I don't necessarily mean you don't have to play in 10 out of 10 every week, but you just have to, we talk a lot about about effort things and 1%ers, like stuff what probably goes unnoticed a lot, but you know your team value it. And I feel like as long as there's people doing them and working hard at them, whether or not you're nailing the more specific sides of the game, you know they're having a dig if they're doing them. And I always felt if I go out there and do them parts of the game, then I can demand that from other people then.
Yeah, that's fascinating, mate. It sounds very similar to what Sean was saying.
Yeah.
Do you think you've got a lot from him? And was there other mentors that have helped you sort of hone your leadership style?
Yeah, I think kind of the culture at Wigan probably from 2010 when Wayne started as assistant to Michael Maguire, that there's still a strong element of that in the team now. Like all the leadership boys, or majority of the leadership lads, have come through that. So you get dragged along with it. You buy into it or you move on. And I think if you buy into it, you kind of value it, and then you pass that on to people around you further down the line. So I think that start of it in 2010 was a big season, because we went, Michael Maguire came in and Werner, and we went from a team what had not done very well the year before. I think we brought Paul Deacon in, the only player we brought in, and then we won it the year after. Before that, I was always of the mindset about the coaches probably get too much credit when things are going well, and they get hammered too much when things aren't. But after that, I seen what like a good coaching partnership was, and how much it did make a massive difference to the team.
So, mate, what I'm interested to hear from you is a little bit more about how you would advise either a new leader or like a new manager going into something. Again, like that example we were using before, like sales or whatever it might be in business, where business or sport, where you've done the role yourself, but then you're stepping up to go into more of a leadership or a managerial role where you've now got to take on added responsibility of other people in your team.
Yeah. There's a saying, I don't know if it's a famous one or whatever, but it came across it a few years back. It's kind of like the standard you walk past is the standard you accept. And it struck home with me a little bit, like when I said I like to, if as long as I'm doing it well on the pitch and nailing my game, then I can demand it from other people then. But I think when you first start off in the role of any kind of, where you take on a bit more responsibility, you can nail your job as much as you can do and do it as well as you can do, but then you have to be like confident enough to pull someone if they're not doing it. I think it's easier. Probably when I got captaincy, I was young, so it was hard for me to be pulling lads who were older than them, saying like, you need to do this, you need to do that. Like, there's definitely an age I found anyway. Some people don't, but when I was younger, I found it hard going to people older than me and telling them they should be doing this, they should be doing that. But I think it's just like anything. I think it's just experiencing it, going doing it, and just putting yourself out there a little bit. I think if you feel strongly enough about something and you feel like you should tell someone something, just tell it, say it. Yeah. I think if the more you do that, the more you have it, you learn if it was the right one, right way to do it or the wrong way to do it, but you get more confidence in doing it the next time or the third time, whenever it is, you have to do it again.
Oh, I absolutely love that. Yeah, each time you do it, it gets a bit easier, doesn't it?
Yeah, 100%. I think that's the same with anything in life. When anything new, you find it hard to do it the first time, or you're nervous about doing it.
Yeah,
but it just gets easier.
How do you put yourself in a position that you make yourself do it the first time? Because that's always the hardest step, isn't it?
Yeah, and I think kind of people have helped me do that. If I remember when an Aussie player, Trent Barrett, who came in, and he tipped me up sometimes about saying stuff to people. He'd be like, he was probably about 4 or 5 years older than me, but he'd been captain at clubs he played at. I remember when he came over here, he was only a year or two, but he was like, you should go on. Not in a funny way or anything, but he tipped me. If it was probably something he'd seen, but rather than him going and saying it, he was like, mate, you should go and tell him to do this, or you should go and tell coaches this. And
yeah.
He was a big help to me. I've been captain a few years then as well, but I learned a lot from him at that time.
Yeah. Amazing, mate. And can you remember any difficult conversations that you've had to have, like, whether it's confrontation or just things that, where you felt like it's a difficult conversation to have, and how did you go about doing that?
Well, Wayne would always involve the leadership boys in like team selection and things like that. So that was hard to sometimes, like, sometimes you a mate who was in the team, and then Wayne would be saying that I don't think he should be, and you'd have to, it wouldn't be about who you wanted in the team, it'd be like what was best for the team. Yeah. Sometimes you have to make some tough calls. Ultimately, they were away in his calls, but it involved us in some of the selection. Conversation-wise, it was normally just pulling lads in line, really. People who you felt were stepping out of line a little bit, and just being a bit disruptive, almost. Like, we'd always have periods in the season where we said, listen, there's a block of four games a year or six games a year. It's they're all tough games, really. So let's stay off the drink, and so let's have a 6 week where we're not drinking, and you'd find out someone had been out for a sneaky one or something like that. That's a bit like, it'd be easy for say let it ride and not say anything, but sometimes you felt like you had to just say it so they knew you knew. So you almost then all we knew about him, it was a senior group, knew about him, and it weren't always going to Wayne and telling him or anything like that, Madge at the time. It was just about pulling him in line, saying, listen, you're out of order, you shouldn't be doing that. And
yeah,
it was just so they knew that we knew and that we were happy with it. Just little things like that, and it's things you could easily let slip, but you feel like if you let it slip, it's then like they're going to do it again. Next time it might be something different, they'll drag someone else along with them.
Yeah,
and so the team knew you'd seen it as well. Team knew you pulled them on it.
Yeah, that's interesting. I can imagine that's one of the more difficult things to do, because everyone wants to try and have fun and enjoy themselves at the same time.
Yeah, and we did, we always have done as a team, but I think when your coach asks something of you like that, which is not a big deal, it's not a massive sacrifice for not having a drink for a few weeks, you almost think you've got to buy in. And we always have small sacrifices, or you hope lead to like the rewards at the end of the season.
Yeah. Did you ever get pissed off with people like when they did do things like that?
Yeah, a little bit. It depended on the characters, really, but yeah, most of the lads what do it end up moving on. They're not kind
really?
Of. They're not. I think the lads what have been here for a long time and value what we have, the same values, they tend to stay around, and they tend to be at the club for 5, 6, 7 years, whatever, and more. Some lads will come in and don't, whether that's younger lads or more senior lads, they tend to, Wayne used to pick up on that kind of thing, and he'd move them on.
Such a good example, like, and a good message for longevity if people want to be successful somewhere. Like, it's not difficult, is it? It's just having consistency with whatever the team around you are doing as well, and not falling in line, but at least having a bit of respect for what people want to.
Yeah, we've got some big characters and funny blokes, and it's not just it's not just toeing the line and doing what you're told, but it's value, it's all having a common value for something, a common kind of goal. And if someone asks something of you that is going to help the team out, then you've got to buy into that a little bit.
Yeah. No, I love that, mate. I couldn't agree more. So we talk a lot on the podcast about like when people have difficult times or they might face obstacles and stuff. And you've spoken already about how when failures occur, you often get big learnings from it and you become better and you grow from that anyway. Is there examples of particularly difficult times that you've had? I don't know whether it may be an injury or other areas in your life where you've had a particularly difficult time.
The year I spoke about when I was made captain, and I said about a lot of senior lads losing, and I had a bad knee injury the year before that. I had like almost a full year off. I think I played in March, and then I didn't play till the following, what would it have been? I think it was like January, February I started back pre-season. So I had like, it was almost 11 months between playing. So that was quite a tough time. I had like a serious knee injury.
What was that? Just like a feeling of being alone and being secluded from it all?
Yeah, I probably, because I was younger, it didn't hit me as hard as it probably would have done if I'd have done it 5 years later on. I think because I was a bit naive to it, it was my first proper injury. But it was probably once I got going and got coming back from things, some of the conversations I had with some of the surgeons, it was a bit like, I was talking about if I'd play again, whereas that had never even entered my head. But as I said, I think because I was naive to it, you just think, I'll hurt my knee, I'll get it fixed, I'll come back next season. It's probably luckily I was young, really, because that probably helped me. But then later on, when I was probably on the mend and a bit more confident, it was coming back. Some of the conversations some of the surgeons were saying, it was like, oh yeah, it was a tough operation and we did well to get you back. And I'm like, Jesus, it was pretty bad.
What was it, ACL?
No, I didn't actually do my ACL. It was my lateral ligament, but I did a lot of damage to the actual capsule and the joint and the muscles around it. So it was in a Wigan Saints derby game, and my knee just kind of buckled to the outside, and it almost, you could see the ligaments snap and give.
How did it feel? Was it, could you feel it, or was it adrenaline?
It weren't like horrendous pain, but it's just when you know it's just shocking when you know you've done something, and the feel of it, I think it shouldn't feel like that. And I remember going getting it, going seeing the surgeon that week after it, and he like held me, I like lied on the bed flat, and he held my knee, put his one hand on my heel and the other hand on the inside of my knee, and then just pushed it, and where it would normally stop, it just kept going. Oh my God, don't do that again. And I nearly threw up on his bed. I thought, you've done your lateral ligament. I went white, nearly puked up on his bed. But yeah, that's probably worst injury I've had, and longest time out I've had.
Yeah.
But it's that alone time, really, when you're in treatment for that long. The boys going out on the pitch, you've seen them playing every week, season, whether it's ups or downs, you go through that as a team. I think when you're on your own in an injury like that, it's just becomes so mundane that you're going in rehabbing, just dead simple, boring rehab stuff, but you just got to do it. But it's mentally quite draining, and probably a bit more sympathy for some of the boys now when you see them going in, because you've experienced it. The only lucky thing for me at the time, probably not lucky for the other lads, but two other lads did ACLs as well, so they were out similar times, so it almost gave us a training buddy.
But what's the self-talk when you're out for 11 months, that's ages, isn't it? And especially if you're hearing the doctor saying you might never play again.
Yeah.
Did it alter the way you're saying it?
Well, he never actually said that until later down the line. I think the physios knew it was serious, but it was only probably more towards when I was getting back, like 6 months down the line, when he actually said to me about how serious it was. And so he never chucked that on me. So it was always kind of about getting fit, getting better. And I think for that amount of time, when you're out so long, you're obviously going to have peaks and troughs in your training. And I think it was just about gearing up for different things. Like they let me go to Mexico for a week, so that broke it up. So like, nice. Once I was back on the men's, like you can have a week off, you can go away, me and my missus. So I went, had a week in Mexico. Didn't have kids at the time, so it was a good holiday. And then come back and boom, straight back into training again. You just try and set your goals in the gym, and just small progressions with the injury, and just keep cracking on with it.
Yeah, patience.
Patience is a massive thing, because it seems 11 months is a long time. And if you're looking at what's going to happen in 11 months, you crack up.
Yeah. It's good they do that. They're obviously trying to lift your morale while you're out
injured. Yeah, I think they give me a sneaky summer holiday, let me go to Mexico, and then brought me in the middle of winter when all the boys are on their rollers.
So do you think that clubs within the Super League and within Rugby League in general, you know, in that situation when you're injured for 11 months, are they doing enough for people who are in that situation?
Going back then, probably not. I think nowadays, like every club's got a welfare manager and things like that, so you kept a lot more under tabs, closer eyes on people.
Yeah.
I think there's conversations going on all the time, and there was people looking out for you, but it probably weren't someone's role to do that. It was more good nature of the people at the club, what just say, oh, just keep, how you doing, how's it going, how's things going, like just little questions like that.
Yeah.
I think it's a specific role for people at the club to do that. They've got to keep an eye on the boys, whether that's injuries, whether that's stuff going on at home, whatever it may be, just keep an eye on the welfare and just seeing how they're going.
Yeah.
Seeing how they're going. Like mental health's a massive buzzword at the minute, and a lot of people talking about it and things like that, but it is important. And it's not necessarily people getting, not everyone gets ill off it, they're not all at that end of the side of things, but just emotionally, I think it is a roller coaster from the sporting side of things, and having people who you can go chat to is a big thing.
Yeah, that's so good. Actually, Sean was talking about getting you guys to fill out bits of information every morning.
Yeah.
About like sleep, whether anything's happened within your family, your friends, or like whether you're not feeling right or whatever it might be.
Yeah, we have kind of I think it's called a welfare profile, something like that. You fill in, but it's there's a few questions on the physical stuff, how you're feeling, and mental stuff. But I think most of the lads will tick that off and do that, whatever it is. But I think the conversations now, think even lads, I think the lads are more aware of it. Lads are more aware of it with each other. And if you think somebody's a bit down or whatever,
that's so good, mate.
I think because it's spoken about a lot more now.
Yeah,
I think there's more. I'm not saying everybody, but I think more boys are in tune with keeping an eye on each other a little bit more than they used to be. It was, I think rugby's kind of known for being no nonsense sport, and I think it was always about toughen up mentality. Whereas I think definitely nowadays, boys are definitely a bit more in tune with each other's emotions. Without saying in. Too silly though, but I think it's if you know someone's down, it's do you like carry on giving them a bit of stick and ribbing them, or do you like have a quiet word and everything all right, mate? And sometimes that's all it takes for someone to open up and tell you a little bit of something, or somebody at home's not well, got going through this, and they, I think they'll feel better off that.
Yeah, it's interesting, mate. In the sporting world as well. You know, our experience, one of the best things is the camaraderie in the changing room, chatting, having a laugh with one another. So it's interesting. I hadn't thought about it like that, because I certainly hadn't experienced any mental health or depression or anything myself when I played sport. It happened afterwards, but interesting to know it's getting more and more common that you can kind of be more aware of people who might be going through that. Have you experienced any of it yourself or with other people in the club?
I know it goes on in the club. It's me personally, I've never been at the end where I've suffered from depression or anything like that. You definitely have down periods where I've struggled injury wise. It's not depression or anything like that. I think the biggest thing, which I'm aware of when I finish playing as well, is having that outlet where you go and end of every week you can go and kind of you go and play a game where you can go and smash people, you go and get smashed. There's an outlet for your energy and your training focus, and there's somewhere you can go and kind of empty the tank and get shut of it all. And I think when I've not played, that's kind of what I've found frustrating, I found tough. It's not the fact that, it's not just the fact that I'm not playing rugby, it's where you channel that.
Yeah.
Where you channel your energy for the week. And I think growing up from being a young kid who's always played every weekend and trained with a focus to go and play, to not have that when you're injured, or to not have that when I retire, I think it's something I know I'll definitely miss.
Yeah, it's interesting, mate. What do you think will be the biggest thing that you miss when you do retire?
That side of things, that having that way of getting shut of energy, getting, it sounds silly, but like it's not like having a fight, but it's that adrenaline what comes with going having a fight with somebody, going wrestling somebody, going getting whacked, going whacking somebody back, that adrenaline that comes with it, you definitely miss that pent up aggression what you can get shut of in a game. And what you touched on before, about the mateship, the camaraderie, what you get with going out training every day with people. I've always said rugby's a great sport, and I've always said how lucky I am to do something what I've enjoyed doing as a kid, do something with friends and make new friends and make good mates for life, and do that whilst also playing a game what I love playing.
Yeah, it's amazing, mate. So as far as your like transition out of the game, you said you're going to try and do one more year.
I think so.
Or more if possible. Keep going as long as possible.
I don't know. My last few contracts, I've always just done with Wigan at the back end of the season. If I've been playing well, if I've felt good, and they're wanting me to go around, I'll go around again.
Yeah, mate. I hope you can keep going for as long as you can. So, what do you think that, if we're talking about maybe skills that you're going to use when you finally inevitably leave the game, what are the sort of areas that you're looking at in your life to try and improve now to prepare you for that?
Coaching wise is something I want to go into. I do bits now with the academy. Well, I've done bits with the academy for probably about 5 or 6 years now, just like night or two a week when I can do, and go down just pass on bits of stuff I know, and just kind of be around coaching kind of coaches as well, learning from them. So I'm doing my coaching stuff now, my badges and all that kind of thing. I'm on with my level 3, hopefully get that done soon. But I reckon for me to go into that coaching side of things, won't necessarily be the rugby stuff. What I'll struggle with, it'll be like the managing things, almost like, you see, the times I spend with the coaching staff, the rugby side of it is easy. It's kind of when I've had conversation with Wayne, he was here, with stuff he deals with away from that, like the people's personal stuff, dealing with players, almost having to give players bad news, but still dealing with it in the right way, picking teams and disappointing people. That stuff, I think, takes practice again. Being able to do it in a positive way, not just delivering it. I think the way you deliver it is big. I've had coaches what have lost changing rooms just on not being honest with players, not being straight up. Like that was one of Wayne's biggest qualities, I thought, and what I tried to learn from him was whether he was giving you good news, or telling you you weren't playing or something like that, he always tried to be as honest as he could with you. And I think if you do that, players can't grumble too much about it. If Wayne says this is, I'm going back to Wayne, I think any coach really, if they tell you you're not in this week because you've done this and this, and you go and work at it, then you can come back and say I've done it, and then it's up to them again if they want to put you in. But if they just kind of paper over why you're not in, people go away and get frustrated and aren't sure where they stand. I think as long as you know where you stand with your coach, you can deliver the hard ones as much as you can, the good stuff. But yeah, I think that is something I'll have to work on when I do go into coaching. But that's probably more from a head coach mentality, someone who's running the club, who's filtering everything down. Assistant side of thing, I think you still got the luxury of it being more about rugby at that stage.
Yeah.
I think when you make that next step up, it's you're dealing with characters and emotions and a lot more.
Mate, that's such good insight, because you got me thinking there about Frank Lampard and what he's doing, and amazing stuff at the moment. And I think you're in a similar position where you've had you've built a legacy at a club. You're officially a one man club, and I know he moved on to other places. But then because he's had such a long time in the game, he's got that incredible experience to know what a player likes, and he's played into his mid to late 30s as well.
Yeah.
Very similar to you, so he knows what players want. He's been through a couple of different eras of the sport as well. I'm drawing a lot of comparisons to the kind of experience that he had as a player and you've had as a player, and that you could take them with you into coaching the management.
Yeah, I think you underestimate sometimes. I think players do underestimate kind of what you learn from the playing side of things. I know it's not a coaching environment, but you spend a lot of time. I think as you get older, you spend a lot of time with coaches. You see a lot of the decisions they have to make. So you are learning from them all the time. I think the character one is a big one. Like, I think you ask coaches about philosophies and what type of players they want and that kind of stuff. I remember getting coached off Wayne Bennett the other year, and I was chatting to him, and he said about you make the most out of the player, or you get the best out of the player. You can have a certain type of player you want, but if you've not got him, you have to be able to get the best out of that particular player and get him playing for you. And,
and
the way he spoke to me about doing it is he said it about almost making them feel like, not making them feel like, because you cheat them a little bit there, but if you invest some time into them and some care into them, they feel like they want to reward you back on the back of that.
Yeah. Yeah. That's so funny, mate. Speaking about that there, again, going back to Wayne, he was talking about how he feels that you guys did that for him in his final game when you guys won the grand final.
Wayne's final year, he definitely pulled on the heartstrings a little bit of the lads as well. And I don't mean that in a bad way. I think I remember him coming around here telling me he was packing in. I was like, taking the mick.
Really?
Like, just like, I can't remember how far into the season. It was about two thirds way into the season. I had no inkling at all he was even thinking about packing in. And he said he's walking away. And I was like shocked. I'm like, you're taking them? I thought he was genuinely taking the mick. Anyways, like from then he kind of knuckled down. He knew he wanted to win that last year, and he was just like that focused. But he definitely used that emotion almost to drive everybody. There was a few other boys what were leaving as well. But I think him leaving had the probably biggest impact, just because it was so unexpected. Like, you boys leave and move on to different clubs, and it is tough. But I think I've not had many coaches what had left on their own accord, really. People have been sacked, people have been poached, I've been gone to other clubs, but he was just leaving with, like, not because he wanted to go on and do something. It was just saw it out of the blue. So he definitely got the emotional strings almost twanging away at the boys.
That's a great lesson in influence, though, isn't it? Because, like, they say, I think, whether it's storytelling or whatever you want to do, if you're involving emotions in that, you're going to have a far better chance of making that thing happen.
Yeah.
So he's utilised that with you guys.
100%, yeah. I know he didn't walk away from it to get that emotion, but as soon as he decided, he made his mind up to go, then he used it the best he could do, and it definitely got more out of us that the back end of the season. We didn't lose a game in the playoffs. It was just, when you speak about form and how you get it, and you can't really always say what you've done well and what you've done good and why you got it, but that just the form and the way we was playing just kind of went from strength to strength as the season went on, and it was a massive factor in him leaving.
Yeah, that's funny, man. It's because it meant more, wasn't it? It was like, you hear the story of if you're lifting in the gym on your own, you're going to lift so much, but if you're lifting and someone's watching you, you're going to lift more because it means more.
Yeah, definitely. There's definitely truth there.
So, yeah, saying earlier, mate, you've been a one-man team. It must bring you huge amounts of joy to have kind of built the legacy that you've got within Wigan and in the town of Wigan and the club of Wigan Warriors as well.
Yeah, when I first started at the club, I think in the first 2 years, sorry, my first year, the club won the Challenge Cup, but I was like a kid then, didn't really play in it. I think I played a few games off the bench that season. Then the following 2 years, I played in two finals, but didn't win them. But then after that, I didn't play in another final until 2010. So I had like kind of a 5-6 year period almost where I didn't make any finals, didn't win anything, all whilst I was captain. So it was kind of coming to a squad what was winning stuff and making finals. I just expected that to be the norm, and then it wasn't. So it took us about 5-6 years to get to grand final, and then when we did it in 2010, it was obviously a massive achievement, but it was such a relief that I'd won something as well, because I'd been around for quite a while and not won anything. To get my hands on a trophy, it was like, shit, I've done it. Like, it was almost like the monkey off the back a little bit. And then from then, we just kicked on. We was making finals regular. We was always competing around the top. I think from that one, I think we won four on the back of, so in 2010, and after that I won three more, been involved with finals most years. So it was just from a period of drought almost, where we'd not done that, and then getting it and then just kicking on and going from strength to strength. It was first of all a big relief, and then just a massive, felt like a massive achievement to have turned, not me personally, but being a part of a team what had turned it round and kicked on stronger.
Yeah, it's interesting, mate. Does it make such much more of a difference? Because, you know, you look at teams who are trying to win stuff, and they say the experience of already being in a final or already winning a trophy just gives you that mentality to be able to go and do it again.
Yeah, I think it definitely gives you a hunger to go there and do it again. You talk about experience and that, and I think it does help being there and having experienced it, going there, doing it again, definitely helps. But it's just, I think it's more a hunger thing. I think once you've tasted it, once you've had it, you want that again. You want to keep doing it. You want to make finals. You want to, and there's definitely an element of experience coming into those games, but the biggest part of it is just wanting it. I think if you want something bad enough, you'll go the extra yard for it, and you'll work harder for it.
When you get a taste, I've heard someone use the analogy of like, when you get the best piece of steak ever.
Yeah, you're never going to go back.
Yeah, you have a bit. He's not going to leave it on one bite.
You're going to tuck in most of it. Yeah, it's
fun. You know, you've had such an amazing career, mate. You've won loads. You said you're coming up to appearance 450. If you had to pick one single moment in a Wigan Warriors shirt as your favourite, your highlight, what would it be?
I think it probably would be the 2010 Grand Final.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was against Saints, which was a bonus. it'd just been a great year. I think, as I said, Michael Maguire came in with Wayne, and we just knew it was a difference straight away. we trained harder than we'd ever trained. The days changed from finishing at like 12 o'clock, 1 o'clock, we was in at 8, getting home at 4. And I know it doesn't sound like, I know it's not a full working day, but I think just so much more time went into the game, videos, the gym, the field, everything had gone up like 20-30%, and it just felt like, even straight from the off, it just felt like it was going to be our year. And then obviously for me, as I said, it was my first time winning something for the club. It just meant, it was a mixture of relief and just excitement that we'd achieved it. It was the best feeling ever. I get asked that a few times, and loads of the finals were great. Even the double we won, that was an unbelievable year, unbelievable end to the season. But I think 2010 was because it had that mixture of relief in there as well, that we'd finally got my hands on something. That's probably what made it a little bit different.
That's amazing, man. Yeah, I hear people talk about the climb so much. Like, the mountain obviously seemed much taller then, because it took 5 years rather than... How long after 2010 did you win the next one?
Won a Challenge Cup the following season, I think. Yeah, I think the year after we won the Challenge Cup, and then we made finals almost for the next 5 years, something like that. We didn't win them all, but we was involved in a couple of grand finals, a couple of Challenge Cups, that kind of stuff. So we'd not just won it and then gone away, we'd won it and built on the back of it as well.
Such an amazing time for Warriors, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was.
All right, mate. So we do the same three questions at the end of every episode, so listeners can take action on immediate pieces of advice you're going to give, put them into their lives, and hopefully help them drive their performance forward. So the first one is... the first one is there anything that you've discovered or come across recently that you're particularly excited about?
As in,
could be anything.
Anything.
Right? Anything that you're in the environment of high performance, of like a professional club. I'm sure there's something you've stumbled across. Or,
well, Matt knew I was growing this. I've been growing kombucha.
Yeah,
is that how you pronounce it?
Yeah.
He sent me a picture when you was swinging on a bottle the other day.
Yeah.
I remember this stuff when my dad was like, when I was about 10, 11, maybe a bit older than that. My dad was growing it.
No way.
He had the little scoby, I think they call it, with all the juice in there, and he used to drink it back then. And I've just seen it resurface recently, like everyone jumping on it, and I thought, I'm gonna get another crack at that. So I've got one of them growing over there.
Are you
growing
it?
Yeah, I've had another bash it brew me on. So,
oh, legend.
Yeah, kombucha, that's the, I get on the kombucha tea.
Locker's kombucha.
I'll see how my first batch tastes first.
Yeah.
See if it's worth sticking with.
Oh, great one. Yeah, mate. It's gone absolutely massive, hasn't it? I mean, I think I first heard of it maybe about a year ago, and then I wasn't too sure about it. And then I've got into it now. I have it quite consistently.
I'm talking 20 odd years ago, my dad was growing it at home.
Did you drink it?
Yeah. He used to let us have a swig of it every now and again. But... yeah, I just come. I'd seen it on sale in a few places. So I thought, sure, that's what my dad used growing up. Is that the same stuff?
It's supposed to be so good for like gut health and
probiotics and anti-inflammatory, all sorts of stuff in it.
Yeah. Oh, mate, so, great one.
Get on that.
Amazing. All right. Yeah, we'll look out for your own personal version.
I'll just see how the first batch goes first. See what it tastes like.
All right. The second one of these is, if you had to give each listener one piece of advice of a habit or routine to incorporate into a daily practice that's going to help them drive their performance, what would it be?
Ooh, that's a tough one. A habit or routine?
I mean, what's your morning routine look like? Is there anything that you do specifically to get you set up for the day, or anything you do pre-match that helps you to get in the right mindset?
Probably pre-match. I like to kind of visualise the game. We used to have a mind coach what came in the club, and he was very into kind of visualising stuff and that kind of thing. But
who was that?
His name was
Damien Hughes.
No, I have had him speak at a couple of things. He came into England camp.
Yeah.
He's done a couple of good books on it.
Yeah.
Yeah. He spoke really well about stuff. But no, Mick Farrell. He was employed by the club for a while. I think he's working at United now with it in the academy.
Yeah.
But he did a lot of psychology work with us, and he spoke about almost like you can you can train him without actually being on the field almost. Yeah. You can put yourself in scenarios in your head and practice them. And that's something I try to do on game day. Just visualize little things, whether it's making tackles, making plays, stuff we've worked on in the week, just playing them over in your head a little bit, like almost playing videos back of against the opposition, actually seeing yourself at the game, seeing yourself, putting yourself in position what you think you'll be in, and just practicing them in your head before the game. I try to, whenever I finish training, leave, like put rugby to one side, come home. When I come home, it's like family time, home time. So, but I do like on game day spending a bit of time. I'll watch a bit of footage on my phone, but then I'll also just try and chill out and do that mental side of things as well.
Amazing. You feel it definitely helps.
Yeah. It's almost, it feels like you run drills in training, but it's almost like you're running mental drills. You're running the drills over in your head, and obviously you're not getting tired, and you're not using any kind of physical side of things, but it definitely helps you practice it.
Yeah, so good, man. I know I've seen studies about it where people have like probes on their head and it can read, I don't even know how it does it, but it reads that it's actually triggering the muscles as well and the physical body.
Yeah.
In the same way, obviously you're not moving, but in the same way, it's like it's sending the signals to the muscles in the same way it would.
Yeah, there's loads of stuff and things behind it, and it's probably hard to prove if it does or doesn't. But I've always felt it. It helps me.
Amazing, mate. All right, and the last of these three is, if you imagine there's two versions of lockers, take yourself back to let's go back just before you turned professional in the game, way before captaincy or anything like that. What's the key differentiator between the version of yourself who went on to have all the success, nearly 450 games, all the trophies that you've had, all the international appearances, World Cup, everything else, and the version of yourself who wouldn't achieve all those things? Like, if you had to pinpoint one trait that made you end up basically where you are now,
yeah,
what would that one thing, what would you put it down to?
Probably being open to changing, probably learning from experiences. You're not the finished article. Yeah, I don't think if you ever feel like you're the finished article, you've probably stopped trying to learn stuff. And I think my game from when I was a kid to my game now is very, very different. And that's probably a little bit down to me, but a little bit down to how the game's changed as well and adapting into the game. But I just think it's being open enough to change and adapt to certain scenarios or certain experiences. Kind of when I got hurt, I was never going to come back and be, I was never lightning fast, but I was never going to come back and be as quick. So you have to develop and learn, make other attributes stronger to kind of compensate for that. So yeah, I definitely think experiencing stuff, whether it's good or bad, but learning lessons and adapting to it.
Yeah,
being open to do that as well, not being stuck in your ways and not being so cocksure of yourself that your way is always right.
Mate, that's amazing. I think so many people are stuck in their ways because of, often it can be like insecurities, or they're just very defensive about their weaknesses, and not being open to that is going to hold them back essentially. How would you advise someone who maybe is not being very open? How can they be more open to change, or more understanding and more aware of areas they need to change?
I think you tend to, if you're doing something well, you'll look at that more. Like, if say I do my review of my game, probably first things I look at is my negatives. Probably go and have a look at what I've, not because I'm being morbid about it, but you know what you do well, you know you can go and do that again, you know you'll keep doing those things. It's probably looking at the negative stuff and addressing that first. If I carry on doing the good stuff and make the weak stuff better, then I'm gonna be a better player.
I can
keep trying to make the good stuff better, but if I don't address the bits, what I'm not doing well, they're always going to drag you back, anchor you down a little bit. I think just looking at your overall performance and addressing what needs to be stronger, not just what you're doing well, is a big deal, really.
Can you still enjoy the game even if you're looking straight into the negatives afterwards?
I'll still watch the good stuff as well, but it's not, I don't feel it, I'm not doing that in a morbid way. It's, I think it's just a realistic thing. Being realistic,
you're loving the process of the development. You want to look
getting better at it.
Yeah, amazing, mate.
I think like even at my age now, you're still always trying to get better at stuff. I think that's one thing coaches have always tried to put in. Other coaches I've I've enjoyed being coached, but I've always driven that, but yeah, getting better at things, no matter how small the improvement is. I think just always keep trying to get better.
Yeah, such a good message, man. That's what the podcast is all about.
Messages, life lessons.
All right, brother. Thank you so much, man. I love chatting. It's good.
Yeah, it's been good. Been good. Must have chatted to you in ages. That's...
Yeah. Just do this every two years. Intense hour, mate. Thanks so much. We're going to get some dinner tonight, maybe, with my cousins.
Yeah, we'll go and grab a feed, maybe watch the rugby this afternoon. Yeah. Tonight.
Yeah, yeah. Who's playing tonight?
He's on. I don't know. I'm not too sure. I'm not too sure who's on that, but there's a big Thursday game up.
Yeah. Nice, mate. And anywhere you want to direct people to? What's your Instagram?
Instagram, Sean, SEANOL13. That's the same Twitter and Instagram, yeah.
Yeah, and then you were doing some work for a charity as well, weren't you? Behind the Smile?
I'll give them a shout out. Yeah, Behind the Smile, a lot I got to know. And he'd had a few things going on with mental health and that kind of things, and he set up this t-shirt brand, this clothing brand called Behind a Smile. I think it's at behind_a smile, something like that. You'll find it anyway if you want to look. But yeah, they're doing good. I did a bit of like a collab with them a few years ago, and they incorporated like Soul 13 into the smiley dot. So yeah, they're doing good things, kind of set up a brand and then kind of pumping money back into mental health issues and things like that, and amazing, helping local people out. So yeah, they're good setup, and yeah, they're doing good things.
Nice. All right, I'm going to check them out as well, mate. Thanks so much.
Yeah, cheers. Thank you very much.
Pleasure. Cheers, mate.
There it is, guys. What an amazing episode. What an absolute legend Lockers is. An unbelievable performer, an unbelievable athlete and competitor. He's done so much in the game, coming up to 450 appearances, and hoping his body holds together and he can get another season in him. It would be amazing if he got to 20. I hope you enjoyed the chat and got loads from Lockers. He's such a great leader and a great personality as well. It was great fun that evening. I went out for dinner with two of my cousins, Lockers and Martin as well, who's one of the guys who works at Wigan. We had a couple of drinks and a good chat and a catch up. And then in the morning, it was an absolute pleasure. I was roped into, but secretly was absolutely loving the fact that I got to train with the injured squad at Wigan in their brand new facility. They've got unbelievable facilities right next to the stadium. We did a ridiculous session with the physio there. It was called Death by What Bike. We put in a ridiculous shift. It was something like 30 seconds on, 10 seconds off, and 10 rounds of that. And then a minute on, and 30 seconds off, and 10 rounds of that. And then in the assault bike. And then we did 3 rounds of resistance weights as well, like smashing it out. So it's no surprise at all the sizes that the lads get with those sorts of sessions. And in truth, I was in my absolute element. We then went on to steam and sauna further down the road. And it was great to meet some of the other lads there. I was training with Benny Flower as well, and some of the other lads, and they're all just top guys. Something we talk about regularly on the podcast is mental health and people who struggle to manage their emotions or manage some of the more difficult things that come up in their life. And I know for a fact that injuries for sports people are one of the things that trigger you to go down that path. You suddenly lose your identity. You don't know who you are anymore when you don't have that routine of the training sessions and the games to aim for on a Saturday. And I can speak from experience when I did my MCL and meniscus playing football over in the States and then coming back to the UK and trying to further my career, but the injuries stopping that too. You start to really question what you're going to do with yourself. It was amazing to see the camaraderie of the lads who are all injured but training together, having amazing times. Although it's such a difficult time in their career because they're trying to get back on the pitch, that's all they want to do. It's so good that they've got each other to go through that with. If you enjoyed that episode, we'd love to hear from you. You can get in touch with me at markwhittle_TF on Instagram and at SeanOL13 on Instagram as well. Don't forget to subscribe. If you subscribe to the podcast on iTunes and follow on Spotify, then you'll be notified of all the new episodes that are going to come out. The next episode is an amazing chat with a guy called Peter McDonough, a former professional boxer, one of the first athletes signed to MTK Global, a crazy story losing his sister to breast cancer 6 years ago, then being diagnosed with a brain tumour this January, having his operation in March, waking up, starting the road to recovery, and 2 weeks after his op, his brother killed himself. But he's such a positive personality, he's such an amazing guy, and it's just a really fun chat, believe it or not. So tune into that next Sunday. I have to say, I absolutely love this chat. I loved the kombucha bit at the end there, that quite surprised me actually, and I got to see Sean's kombucha growing in his house before I left. But go and show some love to Sean, he's such a legend. Thanks again to him for doing this. And until next time, stay positive, stay motivated, and take flight.